Welcome to the Tracking Connections podcast, and thanks for listening.
We feature voices from around the world sharing stories of working intentionally with deep nature connection in ways that transform lives, families, projects, and communities. I'm Sarah.
I'm Aiden.
And I'm John.
And we are your hosts from Living Connection First.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Aiden. Welcome to episode 17 of Tracking Connections.
Hi, everyone. Sarah here with Aiden and John, and our guest today is Shor Charnow.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to be here with everybody. This is John, and yeah, looking forward to this conversation. I'm happy to say hi to you today, Shor, and welcome you into this conversation. Shor and I have been working together for a number of years in a very special design council. We've been working with several other people, really bringing our hearts and minds together around the deep roots of connection, what it really means to be connected, how to be supportive with one another in connection, and how to find unity. In fact, we call it the Unity Acorn Council, and we've been going at it for a number of years, and it's been really, really amazing to work with you, Shor, all these years. And it doesn't feel like work. I always struggle with that word work. It's to be in a dance with you in service to the connection community, I guess is a better way to put it. So yeah, glad to have you here, Shor.
Greetings and gratitude from Grand River Territory in Ontario, Canada. I'm in Six Nations traditional territory right now. And I spent a long time here. I started mentoring in 1994, bringing kids to this river and to this land and working with them. So I'm so grateful that I get to do this recording from that place. And I am a mother of 12. Of those 12, 8 of them got adopted into my world at various ages. I have 6 beautiful and amazing grandchildren. And many promises / threats that there will be more grandchildren to come. And I live on Manitoulin Island, which is the largest freshwater island in the world. And it's at the top end of Lake Huron, not too far away from the north, what you would be considered the north. And it's about 2 hours away from where my grandfather was born, my mother's father, who I never got to meet because he passed when my mom was just a year old. But I feel that connection to that land really strongly when I'm there. And I feel even stronger to that connection that I live there with my husband, Richard, and our 2 youngest children, and my eldest child, and her husband, and my youngest granddaughter. And so, you know, amongst other friends and partners and community members, and I just feel really, really anchored to that land. So it's so special to be able to have those. As a career, I was basically a counselor or a registered social worker for some part of that. But I've been doing counseling firsthand since 1994, and I've been doing kind of frontline presentation, education, support, and help in organic farming and in relationship to the land since 1986. I think I started doing presentations as an assistant to my dad about relationship to the land and organic farming. And then I eventually started my own private practice in counseling as a foundation for relationship to the land, ourselves, and one another. And then have done a lot of other, you know, creation of programs over the years and a lot of community engagement. And so it's kind of coming from that place that I'm speaking. You know, that's some of the bits and pieces around the background that holds me. So I remember that when we were talking ahead of time, the question that came up was, you know, I used to do this library presentation. I still do, but this library presentation talks and speaks to the principle of rekindling connection to begin with. So I really, really like using that framework. But one of the backgrounds of my history when I would go to do these presentations is I would describe how I was raised. And I was raised rather unusually. I was homeschooled because I didn't fit in the school system. They thought I was slow and didn't fit in very well. And I watched for way too long before I became engaged. And that was a problem for them. And there was also challenges around moving a lot and, you know, me being a person who would get up at 4:30 and 5:30 in the morning, ready to go full throttle into life. And so I had that blessing of being homeschooled. I had the gift of having the contrast be having a mother who was raised in the city. She had her mom very connected to the land and would take her to the land, you know, every summer, but they lived in the city. And my mom was lots of fears and concerns about the natural world, but she was very, very dedicated and committed to teaching me about that. So, you know, and then I had my father who was incredibly comfortable with the natural world. He was raised by a Cherokee grandfather and his grandmother. He grew up and lived in Death Valley, California, which is a very harsh environment. And he had all of this experience and knowledge base around the natural world, living in relationship to it, being aware of it, having it inform you and your actions. And so I grew up in this incredible rich environment where my schooling was creating nature journals. My mother got us plaster of Paris so that we could go and fill in tracks and then make reverse tracks and then mimic the tracking patterns. And all of these beautiful things that were a foundation to my level of understanding around the natural world being kind of the starting place. So all my senses were on. By the time I was 10, I was being encouraged by my dad to go run off into the bush at, you know, different times of the day or being sent on night excursions solo. I was in a place of deep friendship with that land. It was my friend because I really didn't relate very well to human beings. I found them confusing and challenging. And so that was the place that I had my conversations about what was happening for me in the world and what was going on. And it became a real adventure for me, you know, sitting for hours and hours watching the river and swimming in the cold when there was still snow on the ground. And, you know, that's the kind of upbringing that I had. And by the time I was 13, my dad made sure that I had the fundamental principles to know how to build shelter, how to clean my water, how to grow food, how to preserve that food, how to make sure that I knew how to hunt, but he told me not to. He said, we don't need to. And so it would be inappropriate to do so. But he said, I want you to know how. And then at about 13 years old, he, you know, asked me to present a meal to our family. And so I went and caught fish. They were in a contained area. So I was wading in with a net, going in, catching them. They had spines that could cut you. So there was a little element of danger there if you didn't get it right. And I was, you know, catching them and preparing them. I was harvesting squash that was from our garden. The food that was on the table that night was food that I had either preserved or helped grow or had caught. And it was kind of proof to my dad that he didn't have to worry about me the same way anymore, that I had done the job. And this was the foundation with which I grew up. And then at 18 years of age, I went out into the big world. My dad called it the outside world. And he had kind of tried to warn me, but my gosh, it wasn't preparation enough. And I started telling some of those stories and people's eyes got as big as dinner plates. And it was very, you know, weird and confusing. I was hoping to form relationships with people from that foundation. And I was met kind of with like sadness because most of my stories and values and beliefs didn't fit with the people I was trying to have those conversations with. So I entered a period of focus where since I couldn't find the adults that I wanted to be in relationship with in this way, I reached out to children and youth at risk and people who had become dissatisfied with the mainstream way of life and ways of being. And they became open and willing and hungry for those stories and those teachings and those sharings that I had to offer. And so I found a place to share from that foundational place for me. And eventually those conversations led me to Coyote's Guide to Connecting with Nature, the first version, by the way, John. And from that place, I got connected to people like John says, refers to the nice people who smell like wood smoke, you know, and in many ways, I found home in those communities and with people in those organizations that have been inspired from Coyote's Guide. And what was really important for me, and what I present when I go to libraries or schools or anything else, is to say, hey, my friend John has this very clear set of wording that encapsulates a lot of the things that I learned when I was young, right? And so can you imagine having these attributes of connection, right? And here's what they are, right? And so I would go through and I would describe to people, you know, happiness of a child, the resilience of joy as the baseline of experience, and this passion and this energy and this enthusiasm for the vitality of life, and this commitment to paying it forward, to deep listening, to, you know, looking, listening, being aware. And then, you know, from that, moving into this place of just an embodied deep empathy and respect that emerges, you know, with regards to the natural world as a whole. And then from that place, how helpful, truly helpful, people are able to be and want to be because they have that motivation and they have that awareness. And then people who, you know, embody this incredible appreciation for life, for the preciousness of it, for the value of it, for the specialness of the opportunity. And they're coming from that place. And then with that gives them this great capacity for unconditional love and forgiveness. And then there's that beginning, ending, and everywhere place, that quiet mind that's described, that place that you can go to with no words, nothing in between the translation of the feeling. It's just the pure expression of life. And, you know, I also recognize that the very, very beginning place of all of it is this, you have to be aware in order to even start this journey. And when you go on this journey, the level, degree, and extent of that awareness grows to an amazing expansion. And so, you know, for me, that's like, okay, those attributes of connection, all right, yep, that describes it. That describes balance for me in my languages. For the friends that I work with at Six Nations, where I was a traditional counselor and mentor to youth for a long time, they would describe it as peace, perhaps. And I like that idea as that baseline of peace. But for me, I usually ask people when I do those presentations, I say, can anybody think of a reason why those things as baseline in a person is not a good idea?
What kind of response do you get when when you share?
Yeah, I mean, the response is, of course, that would be wonderful. That would be amazing. Some people, they're not quite, they're like, well, how would we ever get there from where we are, right? That's the big thing.
Yeah, exactly. Because you're painting such a nice picture of a life in connection with the earth, you know, and in that feeling of the attributes of connection by telling that story of, you know, growing up close to the earth and, you know, the animals and the plants are your teachers and you're building those relationships, running headlong into the shock of, oh my goodness, you know, it reminds me of something I heard the San Bushman say about when they're raised traditionally in the Kalahari, and when they reach that adult age and they're trying to integrate into the modern world, they say, we don't have the immune system that you all seem to have. Every time we try to go on the on-ramp into the modern world, we Bushmen always fall off. And you people seem to know how to, you know, make it in this modern world. We don't have that immune system. That's how they described it. And so you had this really beautiful immersion experience growing up homeschooled in nature. You essentially discovered these attributes. Like when you first read about the attributes or heard about the attributes, did I hear you say that you actually recognized them in yourself? Like, oh yeah, that describes what I have.
Yeah, I did. And even more than that, having a dialogue where, you know, I showed it to some people and said, hey, look at this. And they're like, oh my gosh, they're describing you. Because I had a lot of different perspectives of how people would interpret the way I was. Annoyingly happy. Like there was usually a negative spin to it in terms of, yeah, there's those attributes and they're identified, but they're not necessarily identified from a positive place. Sometimes from a place of jealousy or misunderstanding or misinterpretation. And so, yeah, but it was really, really cool when I saw those in the book and I went, okay, yeah, okay, yeah, I think I can resonate with that. Yeah, okay. Kind of going through that list.
It was interesting for me when Gilbert Walking Bull told us that the children in the program that we were working with all had these attributes and that, you know, these attributes meant that they were leaders. You know, they were going to be like Sitting Bull or Crazy Horse. And it was so confusing to hear him say that because I knew the background on a lot of these young people. They certainly didn't start out with these attributes. So I became very curious and I went and sat with Gilbert after that day and I asked him, you know, what are these attributes you see in these young people? Because he said that his grandfather had told him to watch for people with those attributes. And he said, no matter where he traveled and among modern people, or even when he was going from reservation to reservation, he just wasn't seeing those attributes that his grandfather had described. Then all of a sudden, here he was in the middle of the woods in Washington State with a bunch of teenagers. And he's just like, and Aiden was part of that group, actually, ironically. You know, he couldn't believe his eyes. Oh, my God, these young people have these attributes. They're chosen, he said. You know, they're chosen to be leaders. And I went and spoke to him and said, what are these attributes that you're seeing in them? And when he listed them out for me, and by the way, Shore just did a fantastic job of laying out all the attributes. So, I mean, happiness, vitality, unconditional listening, commitment to mentoring is the third one. That empathy, connection is the fourth one. Being helpful is fifth. And having that awe and reverent spirit, total gratitude for life is the sixth. The seventh is that capacity for love, forgiveness. The eighth one is the quiet mind. And then the ninth one is this awareness thing that Shore was talking about that is around the whole thing. But when Gilbert described those attributes, I'm like, yeah, these people do have that. And they didn't when they joined. You know, like it was literally nature connection that caused it. And people connection that caused it, you know, healthy people connection using, you know, good connective practices. And then it occurred to me that as I look back over the couple of decades prior of doing this mentoring, nature connection mentoring with young people, a lot of them got to that place, you know, whether they were in suburban New Jersey or, you know, in inner city New Brunswick. You know, it didn't matter where they came from or their background, so long as they were in these experiences long enough with support from good mentoring, they arrived at these attributes. So, you know, for Gilbert, like he hadn't seen anybody with him in a long time. And then when he saw these kids, it like woke him up and gave him all this hope. And then he wanted to help. He ended up working with us for a number of years because of that. Right up till his death in 2007, he was very, very helpful and supportive of our work. You present the attributes in this library presentation to kind of mainstream people who walk in, who may never have thought about this before. You build a little bridge by telling the story of your upbringing. Then you talk about these attributes. And they ask the question, wow, can we really even have those attributes? You know, how do we get there from here? What do you say to them? And how do you actually fuse in them the sense that this is possible?
First of all, my theme in my not-for-profit, in my community, and everything in the work that I do, I say we need to build a bridge between where we are and where our future generations need us to be. Because there's a big gap right now. And that gap means that the opportunities that we have in our lifetime and in our world, we may not have those same opportunities for future generations if we don't come back into right relationship with all of life, especially with the natural world, because we're making decisions that are very disconnected from the natural world right now. And that's the life upon which we depend in order to have our own lives. And that connection seems to have been broken. And so I speak a little bit about what the evidence of that is in terms of the number of our youth that are at risk because they feel hopeless or because they feel like there's nothing to go towards. They don't have a pattern. They're hurting inside. And so these are the kids I've been working with my whole life. From the time I was like 18, I was working with them. And so, you know, for me, it comes down to, is it working for them? Nope. Right now, what we're doing isn't working for a lot of them. Is it working for ourselves? Well, let's see. How many people are suffering from depression, anxiety, poor health, confusion, upsets, anger? How many of us can sit with one another and be different? Okay. So it's not working for us as individuals very well. For a lot of us, it's not working for our next generation, and it's not working between one another very well because there's a lot of conflict and competition and upset and people not getting the basics met. And, you know, and there's a lot of one perspective is okay and another perspective isn't. There's all of these things happening. So that tells me that's a big contrast from what those beautiful attributes are describing as what's possible. So we have a gap. And then it's like, okay, so how do we close that gap? How do we work towards bridging that gap? And for me, that then came down to a lot of things that I was doing. But again, when I looked into the core routines that were in Coyote's guide, I was like, yeah, that's a way to get there. That's a way to get there. That's a way to get there. But there's four that I would isolate are the core that all of my elders, that my father lifted up as vitally important. And those four are spend time in the natural world every single day for at least in human time, 20 minutes, you know, spend that time and be quiet and notice and feel and pay attention and become present and become aware and stretch that awareness and ask yourself questions. And you would call that a sit spot. And then the next part of that conversation is find a way to share that, to reflect and integrate that information that's coming into you from that exchange, from that noticing place. And that can take the form of having somebody to speak to. It could take the form of having a group to speak to. It could take the form of writing it down, or for people like me, recording it in a message, you know, that gets logged somewhere. And so you would call that the story of the day. And then the third one for me is that my children have all been taught, as I was taught when I was young, that my feet don't touch the ground in the morning without giving gratitude for the preciousness of life, for the opportunity of life, for the opportunity to learn and to love and to grow. So that is my first practice. And we also often have a glass of water that's beside our bed the night before. And so when we wake up in the morning, we're thanking that water because that's what contributes to us having life. And then the final one that's a much bigger and more involved, but it's like if people really wanted to take the next step into this conversation and this journey, it's what my father called looking back in order to move forward. And it's what you call maybe like the ROCP process, the renewal of creative path process, John. And that's really taking a deep dive into, first of all, when you pass away at the end of your life, what do you want to have as a result? Have you helped? What have you contributed? What do people feel and think about you? What is their experience of you? What do you want that to be? And then go back to the very beginning and engineer the vision that you have for your life. And so that renewal of creative path process is really clear. And so for me, in that library presentation, part two, And there's a pamphlet with one side is the attributes of nature connection, and the second side is the core routines. But just this looking back in order to move forward, this ROCP is noticing connections, what connects you, noticing what disconnects you, noticing the synchronicities that could help guide you, noticing the stepping stones, the major decisions, the major crossroads in your life, noticing and asking others to reflect back to you what uniquenesses of how they contribute are. You know, how do they contribute in the world? How do you contribute in the world in a really good way? And what is that uniqueness for you, that unique combination? And then moving from there into recognizing that there are things that you've carried throughout your life that may or may not serve you now, but they were probably very useful at some point in your life. Maybe there was a crisis, or there was a challenge, or there was different things that happened that you needed to be a certain way, you needed to act a certain way, you needed to navigate in a certain way, right? And they became habitual patterns of behavior. But then when you move into a different circumstance and a different situation, they may no longer serve you well. And I, in psychology, would call those adaptive strategies. And not all of them work anymore well. So we need to, you know, update them and say, hey, is this still working? Do I still keep this in my toolkit? Or is this really worn out and inappropriate and doesn't do the job? And maybe what do I need to look at? Maybe there's another tool I need to bring into play. And then embracing what's left over, because there's now room, that we've got space now because we've let some things go that weren't the best fit. They weren't the most ideal. And so now you're moving into a place of, okay, we can embrace the best combination of things in our lives that are the best fit for now. And then moving from that place to that ideal scene, the place and space of a vision. You know, what do we want? How do we want to walk moment by moment, day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year? Or in my way of looking at it and others, day by day, or sunrise to sunset and sunset to sunrise, you know, through the whole moon cycle and through the seasons and through those consecutive ways of rotating. And that's the way that we craft that quality of life. And so a lot of people say to me now, you've done so much in your life. Well, I had an early start. You know, by the time I was 13 or 14 years old, I knew very clearly how I wanted people to experience me, see me, what I wanted to create, how I wanted to contribute, and what I valued, what was important to me. What I wanted to have in my life and what I didn't want to have in my life was pretty clear. And it hasn't changed in my whole adult life. That really hasn't changed that much. There's been little incremental improvements and discoveries that have happened as a result of me landing myself in the middle of something and going, whoa, this really doesn't feel like what I want. Okay, that gives me some clarity about what I might want to change to and have. So let me take the hint. So that's basically the library presentation. So
Thank you, Shor. That's so inspiring. I love it. And I wonder if there's a pamphlet that we could share with folks, the one you described there with the attributes on one side and the core routines on the other, core routines of nature connection and connection with self and other. I'm really interested in, you know, you were talking just now about knowing what you wanted to create. And I know that you have created an event that you're holding on Manitoulin Island called Rekindling Connections. And I also understand that it's been designed using the Eight Shields model and also the art of mentoring that we've spoken about in the Eight Shields Masterclass, as well as some other podcasts. So I wonder if you would share with us a bit about the design around the Rekindling Connections event and how it applies to the HDLs, how it's also incorporating the principles that you've been talking about of, you know, the attributes and using the core routines of connection to bring out the attributes in people.
The one final thing about that vision that's different, you know, in the ROCP process, you know, it has those eight steps, but when my father taught it and my elders taught it, we added one more thing, which is when we get our vision, we measure it up to our ancestors. You know, are we honoring the joys, the celebrations, the sorrows, the challenges, the sacrifices that our past generations made in hopes of a better future for us? More possibilities, more stability, more access to life essentials, less struggle, right? And so we measure up our vision, our personal vision against that. And then we also measure it up from a place of, are we in balance with future generations? Will this contribute to future generations? Our own personal vision, will it support or will it steal something away from them? Will it take too much? Are we coming from a place of need or greed, as my elder would have said? And so that's the framing behind that creation process. And so I went to several Art of Mentorings in and around 2011, 2012, and up for a few years. And then I had a series of conversations. And what I experienced going there was, you know, I had an invitation from Mark Morey. And I think he had a little bit of an understanding that I might be walking in with a different background than some. And he said, I would like you to just watch for the whole week. And then I'd love to have a conversation with you after. And I walked through that whole event kind of in a daydreamy kind of state, because it was like, I see what they're trying to do. I see how they're trying to invite people into an experience and a connection with the natural world. And I see how they're trying to encourage that to happen inside of a person. And I see how they're trying to get that to connect in a common journey with other people. And I can see the layers and the levels of the villages that no longer exist. And I can see what's happening for people as they kind of, their nervous systems go, oh, wait a minute. There's a nutrient here. There's a soup. There's a combination of something that's happening that is stirring something inside me. It's waking something up and it's visceral. And so I could see those things. And I, at the end of the week, you know, this was my reflection. I said, and my hands are up and I want to help. But the other thing I said was, he said, did we miss anything? And I said, well, I would have liked it if they were invited to consider learning how to breathe before we sent them out on the land, because I saw a lot of people in almost like hyperventilating. They were like breathing from their chests and their shoulders are wrapped up around their ears, and they're really like nervous going out into the natural world. And if there could have been a couple of moments of just presencing, relaxation and framing an invitation, like go out there and have fun. Like go meet this friend that's around you all the time, but you haven't been in conscious and deliberate dialogue with maybe. And just, you know, how different maybe their experience would have been if they knew that, if they had that experience. And so they did. The very last session, everybody learned how to breathe. It was very fun. But what I heard from people as I interviewed, and I talked to dozens and dozens and dozens of people over the next few years about the Art of Mentoring experience. And what I heard was volunteers were very stretched and strained. Meetings went early and late. There was burnout that was quite possible for many of them. The elders felt rushed, you know, needing nap times and stuff like that. The families that had small children, you know, didn't feel like they had adequate time for, you know, meals or things like that. And there was a very large barrier to a larger group of people in terms of like cross-cultural barriers, and then, you know, barriers relating to people that are different neurobiologically, which is my whole world and the people that I work with often. And so I wanted to take all of that input into account. And I also wanted to turn it from a program to an invitation and a reflection around a possible way of life. So how do we make, you know, instead of it being a program that has all this information at once in it, how do we pare it back to the essentials? How do we leave lots of time for meals, lots of time for integration, reflection? Nap time is encouraged. Volunteers have rotational ways to feel at ease. How do we support creating places and spaces where people, if they can't participate in content, have that still container to support and help them as they go through a journey that's in this container that's happening? And so I want to make a distinction that there's the Rekindling Connection as a program. And then what we're doing this year, 2024, is we have Rekindling Connection, the gathering. And that's not a program. That's just people who have had that experience or want to step into an existing community, where this is our aspired way of life day in and day out, and the work gets done, the land stewardship gets done, the connection gets done, the core routines get practiced, the conversations happen, the support is there. And so next year, 2025, we will be running a very large, held, supported program where we already have a whole bunch of instructors and key volunteers that want to come together and do this in a really big way. And so we're just kind of having that heartbeat. And we suspect there'll be more gatherings that will happen, but we wanted to make it so that there are literally pathways for some people where they bring a brown paper bag lunch and they're coming in and their contribution is helping us with land stewardship rather than the finances. Or there's another way that they're able to give back and still be part of it. And because we have very culturally diverse people in our community on the island and in the larger community. And so this year for our gathering, we have people coming from all over the states. We have people who are traveling, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 days to be there. But it's a gathering. We're not going to be talking about the content. We're going to be doing the practices around stepping into a village that already exists and helping to lift that village up and support it. And then also having something that people take back with them in terms of an idea of what does it feel like, look like to be in community where they're practicing this on a daily basis.
I love that so much. Sure. It's amazing to it reminds me very much of the time that I spent when I was at Wilderness Awareness Community School and, you know, among that group of teenagers that Gilbert described as having the attributes that was essentially our day-to-day experience, right? Was coming in and practicing all of these things, starting your morning around a fire that you started without matches and gratitude first thing and, you know, and moving into whatever the flow of the day is, but just getting a chance to really sink into the practice and to experience it and how that helps you bring it into your day-to-day life. And I'm curious if you have any advice for, I'm really thinking of parents and aunts and uncles right now who are hoping to start this with their kids and practice this on a regular basis. If you have any advice on how they would go about getting started on those four routines, and I suppose really the first three, if we're talking about children, right? The nature connection and the story catching and the gratitude. What have you seen as the most effective way to kind of go from zero to it's happening?
Oh, I love your question, Aiden. That's so awesome. And this is what I do all the time. Like I have a whole not-for-profit designed to do just this. What often I tell it, parents and or siblings that are older looking after or aunties or uncles or grandparents is if there's a park nearby, go to the park every day. Just the journey there, a few minutes at a time, and just like go with, you know, with their experience of introducing them to those aspects, like you know, the deer ears cupping your hands behind your ears and owl eyes, right? To be able to look far and to look close, you know, the raccoon touch, like use your fingers to feel all the different dimensions of the tree, getting to the place where they do their doggy sniffs, right? And they learn how to smell and pay attention and track that smelling, and then learning how to do the fox walking. It's like those five basic sensory things are a starting place over time, but it's most of all, it's about go with so much enthusiasm and excitement, like you're going to plan a trip to Disney World for most folks or something like that. Just like super excited and curious. And what are we going to discover today? Not we're going to go learn about, right? Don't walk in there with an agenda. When you work with small children, I've run daycares, I've run schools, I like so much programming. And what I say is shift your attention to a place of curiosity and receptivity. Go in there adventuring the same way that those children could experience it. And let's just see what happens. And then when you go home and you have your lunch or you have your dinner or you have your snack, whatever time you have, like spend a couple minutes. It's like, what was the thing that made you the most excited or the happiest? Or, you know, what was your favorite part? Or, you know, what were the pieces that it was like, oh, I'm never doing that again. Bring humor into it. Bring emotional expression. Use it as an opportunity to teach children that a wide range of emotions is okay and acceptable and welcome. And that's just all part of you. And then make sure you're lifting up that I'm so thankful we got to do this. I'm so, you know, whatever way that is, whatever way you want to bring gratitude in. But recognizing that, you know, for a lot of teachers in the First Nations communities and the elders that I used to work with, you know, they said, if we don't say thank you to those beings, they don't know that they should continue to show up. They don't know that they're wanted. And when I tell it to kids, I say, do you know you're loved? And they go, yes, 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 most of the time, right? And when they, and I say, what? Oh, you're loved. Well, mommy tells me, or grandma tells me, or grandpa does this with me, or uncle takes me to do these things. And I said, so how do the trees know we love them? How do we treat them right now? What do we do with them right now? What happens? And it starts to wake up those conversations with those kids about like, oh, how do we treat the natural world? And then my encouragement to kids when I'm with them running program, I'm like, can we do better? Do you think we can do better? And everything is framed around, you know, what's going really well and what needs work. And not ever coming from a place of blame or shame or judgment, or that we should feel bad for what's there right now or where we are. But what do we want moving forward? Let's look at where we are now. And let's look at where we would like to be and how can we make that possible? And you're naturally teaching people from that place very easily.
Wow. Sure. Thank you. I mean, you gave a beautiful workshop for everybody, and Aiden and Sarah and I didn't have to do very much, but listen and appreciate, yeah, your experience and your stories are really, really helpful. Thank you so much for taking time along the Grand River and talking to us here in California on either side of the Santa Cruz Mountains in Ohlone country. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Shore, so much. I can feel your passion and your emotion is very contagious. Right, that's that vitality, right? Those are those attributes, those childlike attributes that come out when we do these connective practices and, you know, teaching it back to the children that this is encouraged and this is okay, right? That we also as adults need to remember that. So just really feeling grateful for the work that you do in this world and how you really are embodying the teachings and providing, not only as an embodied person, but an embodied village. You know, you're working toward that actual living experience with other people on the land. It's really beautiful work and really inspiring. Thank you.
Yeah, and just the way in which you are finding the joy and gratitude and connection in these moments and modeling that for all of us, I think we all would have a lot more joy in our lives if we remembered to be grateful and connect with every little thing that we discover in the world. And I just loved how you brought that out and talking about that with the children and their natural way to do that. And yeah, appreciate it.
Well, thank you guys for giving an opportunity to share. As you can tell, I'm really enthusiastic and passionate about it, and I can't turn it off. And it has allowed to carry me through so many things that have been challenging in the world that we walk with. And all I basically tell people is, if you want to take it further, like, come and help in whatever way you do. So we have this large community that some people come and help by talking to us on the phone. Some people want mentoring in little specific ways. Some people want to contribute to this in different ways. We have work trade programs. People can come and, like, actually live there for a week or two or whatever at a time. But this is an ongoing thing. It's happening all the time. And it's a work in progress, always. There's always, always a work in progress. But it just feels like so much. And the hope is that once we feel like we've got it dialed well enough, that we really feel like it's something, you know, we have a recipe book for, then, you know, the goal is to be able to help other communities. And we've already got that request to help other communities who want to bring a program back into their community, or they want to start something in their local neighborhood, or they want to do something, and just saying, okay, there are simple ways to do this. So I'm super grateful for the opportunity to share my enthusiasm about it, and for the conversations leading up to it, and for finding like-minded people to get to work with all the time, and John, for the connection that just continues to grow from the work over the years. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And hopefully you'll get out there and make a Disney adventure out of the walk to the park. I love that image. So thanks, everyone. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Tracking Connections. You can find everything related to the podcast and our current offerings at trackingconnections.net. We'll see you next time.